Dear Ajahn, do I understand correctly? No. Of course you don't. You've got to be fully enlightened. Okay, what's the question? Do I understand correctly that the goal is to let the mind get still by observing the breath and thereby keeping it from thinking or wishing? Happiness boosts the process. All other things follow from the stillness of mind automatically. Yes. So the happiness boosts everything. And a lot of times the reason why we think or wish is because we're not happy. Interesting. If you're really happy, you don't need to think. All thinking comes from discontent. When you're really, really happy, at peace, everything's okay in the world, you don't need to think. You want to spoil it for the thinking. So when you really get happy, your thinking just starts disappearing. And that's how you let the mind get still. Happiness boosts the process. All other things follow from the stillness of mind automatically, exactly. How much focus should one exactly put onto the breath to keep the cup down and still not lose the mind to thinking, etc. all the time? That's really for you to decide. You put the focus on the breath, but if you find that it's getting unpleasant, you'll start thinking a lot. If you're watching the breath and it's really nice, then you won't think. So just see how the happiness goes. Don't work too hard. Dear Ajahn, I once heard someone say that the best way to give back to our parents is not through material things, but by teaching Dharma. This is for my mum, who is on this retreat. Please explain. Much metta. Yeah, but first of all, you cannot teach your mother. Don't even try. It's really true. Because, look, I was a great teacher. I gave up straight away after about 1 or 2 years. There's no way I could teach my mum. Any other monks or nuns, they could teach her, but not me. And I read that Sariputta, the wisest monk next to the Buddha, he used to go and visit his mother, and his mother would always scold him. I don't know how old sort of his mother was, but the story was that Sariputta was 80. You know, he was just about to die, just a few months before the Buddha passed away. And he went to visit his mum with a few of his monks. And as soon as his mother saw him come, he said, "You again. When are you going to get a proper job?" And he was 80. And, "Okay, you want me to come and feed you again? Okay, come inside the house." And then what happened was that Sariputta, he got this very bad diarrhea. And then he was dying. And then all these devas came to visit him. And first of all, the lower devas came there, and this brilliant light in the room. And his mum said, "Who was that?" He said, "Oh, that's just a deva come to pay respects to me." "Oh, really?" And then a brighter light, and then a brighter light, and a brighter light. And then after a while, the Mahabrahma, the great god, came. And his mum said, "What was that? That was just incredible light in your room." "Oh, that's the one you worship all the time, God. He just came in to say goodbye to me." And at that, she said, "Son, what have you been doing?" And that was when she got some faith. And then he could teach her Dhamma, and then he passed away. So, you know, he needed a few enlightened deva beings actually to convince your mum. So if you really want to convince your mother, you invite some heavenly beings to come along and impress her first of all. And then maybe she might listen. So that's always the case. So if ever I wanted someone to teach my mother, I'd get another monk to do it, because they would listen to me. But not me, no way. Because look at it, your mother, you know, you came out of her belly. You know, she's been teaching you since you were really tiny, and you can't get rid of that relationship of a mother to a child. So the mother will always be the teacher to a child. So there's no way you'll be able to teach your mum. Get someone else. Another monk can teach, or nun can teach your mother, and then sort of I can teach somebody else's mother. So that's the way it works. So it is. The best thing you can give back to your parents is through teaching them Dhamma. So the only way to do that is get them on this retreat, and then if you pay for them on this retreat, that's marvelous. You're actually giving them the gift of the Dhamma. It's brilliant. Dear Ajahn, how does one practice metta without controlling, especially when it involves the repetition of a deliberate intention with metta? So it's a little bit of controlling at the beginning. May all beings be happy and well. But as soon as you've made that aspiration, may all beings be happy and well, pause and listen and feel. What does it feel like when you recite that word, may all beings be happy and well? You have a little bit of metta in your mind and even in your body. Repeat it, may all beings be happy and well. May all beings be happy and well. Because every time you give an instruction to your mind, the mind starts looking in that direction and starts experiencing metta. The words are just to point the mind in that direction. So don't keep repeating the words. Repeat the words, then look in that direction until you can feel metta. Until you actually, your mind is full of metta. You don't need the words anymore. You know, you've followed the signposts, you've got to the destination, you're at metta. So then you feel metta. And if you really get used to this, feeling what metta means, not the word, but what it points to, and you cultivate that experience, you get to know what that experience is, familiar with it, and at ease, you can actually feel metta. And then you can use that, and that's powerful. You can get that into nimittas and jhanas all the way. So the point is, not just the words, we've got to feel. What do those words mean? So example, peace. 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 Did you feel some peace? Did you get to your head around it, what it is? And once you've got your head around what it is, you don't need to say the word anymore. You have peace in your mind. When it fades away, then say the word again, peace. You keep on saying it until you don't need to say the words anymore. You have peace right here. So this is how we use loving kindness. We use the words to generate an emotion, a feeling. And when that emotion is strong, we focus on the emotion, not the words anymore. The words have done their job. You've got that beautiful emotion. It's beautiful. You can visualize it like a golden light in your heart. You visualize that, because sometimes visualizing it helps. And we're doing that on Sunday, the metta meditation. So it is some words to generate the light or generate the feeling, and then you leave it looking after itself. Dear Ajahn, in the sutra, if someone doubts on the Buddha, why they have bad karma? It's not so much if they doubt, but they get angry at the Buddha, or they try and upset the Buddha, or... Because if you just try and cause harm to anybody, that always is bad karma. So if it's like real doubt, you just say, well, I'm not really quite sure. Then that's no problem. That's not bad karma. That's just being honest. But it's like when you want to harm the Buddha or curse the Buddha, or the worst thing is actually stopping other people going to listen to the Buddha. Well, actually, I was very proud of that, because when I was in Singapore a few years ago, there was... I was giving a big talk at, you know, this big temple, about 2,000 people in the hall. And I was told there was a group of Christians outside trying to stop them going in. And I thought, yes, at last, I've got them rattled. In Singapore. So, and the other time I was giving a big talk there, and there was the riot police were outside. And I remember just the person organizing, because, you know, we totally overpacked the hall in Singapore. This was in a public utilities building auditorium. And people were sitting everywhere. And the organizers, they were terrified. This was Singapore. You know what it's like in Singapore? They're incredibly strict. And they said, there's a riot police outside. They're going to come in. And then we found out they did some asking questions. And there was actually a nightclub around the corner. They were actually more interested in the nightclub than in me. And when I found out, I was very disappointed. I thought I could add that to my CV. It's a very boring life as a monk, so you want to sort of have some interesting stuff. Anyway, so that's actually, it's not really doubt. Doubt is good. In the sense that you're asking questions. Dear Ajahn, is the total number of jhatic... the total number of jhana is 4. Are they Sowan, Sakadagami, Anagami, Arahat? No. Jhana is the 4 jhanas. These are the ones of the 4 stages of enlightenment. If one sees the first jhana, the next time before he gets the second jhana, does he need to go through the first one again? Thank you. What happens is the second jhana is within the first jhana. It's right in the center of the first jhana. So you always have to go through the first jhana to get second jhana. In order to get the third jhana, you've got to go through the second jhana, because the third jhana is right in the center of the second jhana, and the fourth is right in the center of the third. We always go in. That's actually an important point in meditation. You never go on to the next stage. Always go in to the next stage of meditation. Remember those old Russian dolls? You know, the one inside the other, inside the other, inside the other. That's meditation. So you start off with this body. Inside the body, you'll find the present moment. Or you find the mind, first of all. And inside the mind, with all its thinking and past and future, in the center of that, you find the present moment. In the center of the present moment, you'll find the stillness, the silence. In the center of the silence, you'll find your breath. In the center of the breath, you'll find the full awareness of the breath. In the middle of the full awareness of the breath, you'll find the delightful breath. In the middle of the delightful breath, that's where the nimitta comes from. In the middle of the nimitta, you get the first jhana. In the middle of the first jhana, you find the second. It's always going in. What do you think happens when you really go in? In the middle of the third jhana, is the fourth jhana. In the middle of the fourth jhana, is the first immaterial attainment. In the middle of the first immaterial attainment is the second. In the middle of the second is the third immaterial. In right in the center of the third immaterial attainment is the fourth immaterial attainment. And the center of that, you know what's in the center of that? That is the end of everything. That is a jewel in the heart of the lotus. You know what's there? Would you believe me if I told you? If you did, that means you're gullible. How do you know if what I'm saying is correct or not? Anyone who just believes because they're told is stupid. So don't believe what I say. And if you don't believe me, it's not much point me telling you anyway. There's nothing there. Please explain about the meaning of non-self and how to achieve it. Today you've taught us to meditate, visualizing our good actions, good speech, etc. Everything has to do about ourselves. Thank you. It's hard to visualize other people's stuff. Okay, you can fantasize about other people's stuff, but you don't really know other people's stuff. So all you've got to work on is your stuff. So work on your stuff, first of all. And especially work on your good stuff. All that bad stuff. Just assume that wasn't really you. There's an old Sufi story of this Sufi teacher. And at the end of a retreat, for a bit of a reward for all his students, he took them to a fair. And at the fair, there was an archery stall. And together with all his students, he said, oh yeah, I'm a good archer. I can sort of shoot arrows from a bow. And so he paid a couple of dollars and got 3 arrows. And you know, if you hit the target, you get teddy bear. So he put the first arrow in the bow and shot it, and it only went about halfway to the target. And they asked him, have you ever shot an arrow before? He said, no, I never have, but it's easy. But that was the shot of a hasty man, he said. That's why it only went halfway. It's just too hasty. So the next arrow he put in his bow, and this time he took a bit more time. Relaxed himself, pulled it a bit further back, and shot it. It made the distance, but went about a mile to the right, almost killed somebody. And they said, look, give up, you know, people are laughing at you, a well-known teacher. He said, no, that was a shot of a proud man. And he put his third arrow in the bow and said, come on, get out of here, you're making an idiot of yourself, you can't shoot bows and arrows. And the third arrow, of course, went straight in the middle of the target. And as he was collecting his teddy bear, his students asked him, well, look, if the first shot was a shot of a hasty man, and the second shot was a shot of a proud man, who was the third shot? And he said, oh, that was me. Now, that is wisdom there. When you make mistakes, you know, you're not in your right mind, okay? Now, it's a mistake. I was grumpy today. I wasn't feeling good. I was a bit off my game. So whenever you make mistakes, excuse them and pass them away. But when you make something success, claim that was me. Why not? That's letting go of the failure of the past and collecting the happiness of the past. That's why, look, any complaints on this retreat, anything you don't like about what I've said or my behaviour or anything else, any complaints, tell Daniel or Bianca. Any compliments, you come up and tell me. I only receive compliments. Complaints, you can just throw them away. Now, I'm serious about that. Because when you collect the happiness, you actually learn much more from happiness than you ever learn from mistakes. And if you keep focusing on the happiness, the goodness, all your successes, you tend to learn the secret of success, the secret of happiness, which means you repeat happiness. But those people who keep thinking about the mistakes and trying to analyze why it was a mistake, why was my meditation terrible, why was today an awful day, when you analyze your mistakes, you get depressed. You're reinforcing the sort of the depression instead of just letting it go. And you think, oh, I'm going to learn from my mistakes. You don't learn from your mistakes. You just get depressed and upset and angry like most people do. But if you remember your successes, what worked, why you were happy, learn from that. And then you learn the secret of happiness. So that's where it works. So you've got to work with what you've got. Non-self, I'll talk a bit about tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, in Vipassana retreats, the teachers normally suggest that one labels, note each action, e.g. touching, seeing, hearing, to cultivate mindfulness. Would Ajahn also recommend this? No, because there's a famous story which I invented of one... That's why it's famous, okay. Well, you know, give credit where credit's due. I just said, you learn much more from successes, so why not praise yourself? And even if you are, I know, okay, monks are supposed to be humble. You know, humility is an important factor of, you know, the spiritual path. But if you are humble, if you are humility, you know, you should tell people about it. What's the point of being humble if nobody knows? So, so humility flaunts it, as I say. Anyway, So there was this rich woman. And she came to one of the talks at the temple one evening. But before she came to the temple, she told her guard, you know, all these people live in rich mansions, have a guard at the entrance. She told the guard, look, there are burglars around and they know I'm going to the temple and they may try and steal from my house and there's lots of wealthy, rich stuff in there. So, guard, I want you to be mindful. And the guard said, okay, madam, yes, I've done many Vipassana retreats, I will be mindful. And so off she went off to her, she went off to the temple, heard a nice talk. When she came back, of course, the robbers had been right through her house and stolen everything. So she was very upset at the guard and went to scold him. Look, I told you to be mindful. And you said you've been meditation retreats and you're about mindfulness. Why did you let sort of my house be robbed? And the guard said, madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going in, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking out all your expensive jewellery, and I noted, expensive jewellery going out, expensive jewellery going out, expensive jewellery going out. I saw them drive their truck next to the house, say, truck going in, truck going in. I saw them taking your safe and putting it in the back of the truck. Safe going in the back of truck, safe going in the back of truck, safe going back. I was very mindful. I noted everything, madam. Of course, that's stupid. You're not just supposed to note. You know, if somebody, if the burglar's going in, you're supposed to call the police or stop them or do something, for goodness sake. So just noting is not enough. So I apologize to Vipassana teachers, but they deserve that. Dear Ajahn, during a sit this afternoon, I had a very, oh great, a scary experience. I love scary experiences. My mind felt very heavy, very dark, almost evil-like. Amazing, because when you see it, sort of the movies, or you see on the TV, I look at what's on the TV, and it's all evil stuff. Vampires, monsters, all evil stuff. Evil locks.
Absolutely.
Anyway, what have we got here? What type of evil have we got here? There was an ominous buzzing sound in my head, and it felt like I was losing my mind. That's what you're supposed to lose. Now, did I tell you to get lost? There you were, about to lose your mind and become enlightened, and you got scared. God, gee. Then it was spiraling out of control into darkness and foreboding. It was very frightening. I took myself out into the open amongst people and had something to eat and drink, and after about an hour, most of the sensation diminished. Ah, what a shame. Is this normal, or is it time to apply the straitjacket? Hoping you can shed some light on this darkness. Okay, remember, just whatever you're experiencing, it's your attitude towards it which is most important. If you get scared to things, then it actually becomes like dark and foreboding and evil. It's just an ordinary meditation experience, and that's what you add to it with the, you know, the bad reaction. And that's why you create all this difficulty and darkness. Instead, if you'd have changed your reaction and say, oh, it's just dark, beautiful, empty darkness. Don't you like the night time? When it's so dark, all you can see is just the moon and the Milky Way. It's beautiful in the darkness. In the night, in the light, you know, the Milky Way is up there somewhere, but it's, you can't see it, it's too bright. So darkness is great. And it's very, very heavy, yes. Just the heaviness of the Dhamma. So, what's that saying go? He ain't heavy, he's my brother. Because heavy, you know, it's like heavy metal, heavy rock, sort of heavy Dhamma, that's really cool. So you change the attitude that heavy is good. Because, you know, look at me, I'm heavy. That's good. So I felt heavy, an ominous buzzing sound in my head. Well, if it's buzzing, where does the buzzing come from? Bees. So you're being. I told you, this is all about being. So where there's being, there must be buzzing. Okay, never mind, I tried. And I felt like I was losing my mind. That's what you're supposed to do. They're spiraling out of control. You're supposed to let go of control. So the foreboding is what you added to it. Now, I'll tell you one of my stories. So you were okay, it's just that you overreacted. Years and years and years ago, when I was meditating, okay, now getting into these nimitta states, you can see all sorts of stuff. And now my eyes were closed, but the vision was very, very clear. It was a monster. This big monster you can see right in front of you, with big bulging eyes. You know, like a monster, big bulging eyes. And teeth, you know, just fangs, you know, dripping red blood. You know, not ordinary teeth, you know, just sharp teeth. And just scowl, and a necklace of skulls around it, and go, that's what it was like. Now, but if that happened to you, say, this is evil, I want to go home, this is a monster come. But this is my attitude, okay, and this is what I encourage you to do. When I saw that, I knew that, you know, these are creations of your mind, you can mess around with them. So on these big bulging eyes that were coming out of their sockets, I put a pair of Ray-Bans on. You know, like dark glasses. All you need to do is think that and it happens. Because they're in the realm of the mind. You know, whatever, you can create anything. So I had this really cool, like Elvis Presley sunglasses on. And in its mouth, you know, I put a cigarette. Because that's what I used to do at school, you know, just do doodling on sort of pictures. Got into trouble at school, but this was very good practice for when I meditated. So I can put a cigar or a cigarette out of its mouth, blacked out a few teeth so it looked like it needed to go to the dentist. And that's why I put a straw hat over its head, it had spiky hair, a straw hat with a flower coming out. And that, I just thought that, and it happened. I had this monster who looked totally ridiculous. You know, absolutely, you know, a joke for a monster. And I just laughed. I totally humiliated that monster. And it vanished completely away, never came back ever again. That is the way to treat evil. Just humiliate it. And I taught that there was, oh, I don't think I only taught this once. There was a guy who was spending visiting Bodhinyana Monastery, and he came up to say, "Look, I'm going crazy. Now I've got some deep meditation. When I see the paving bricks there, out of the paving bricks, these monsters come up to me. Should I go to see the doctors?" And I said, "Oh, no, you don't need to do that. Do what I did. Play with the monsters. And you can actually, you know, mess around and put glasses on them, you know, a monocle if you want, with a nice bowler hat like an English monster would look. And play with them." And he said, I saw him late in the afternoon, and he said, "Oh, I had a great day. It was just so much fun playing with all my monsters, but they've gone now. But I had a really wonderful day, you know, messing around with them this way, messing around with them that way. It just took all the fear away, which was the problem. The monster wasn't a problem, the fear was the problem. And he played around with them, that was it, they went, and they never came back again for him." So that is the way to deal with any sort of experience like that. For goodness sake, play with it. If it feels heavy, just how heavy it can be. And just imagine, just, you know, you're getting heavy, just as big like Fat Buddha. That is actually, you know, the Fat Buddha is supposed to be very auspicious. And that, when I was in Korea, and they looked at me and said, see, I'm a bodhisattva. And I said that. They all thought I was really, really funny. Because I'm supposed to be a Theravada monk. We're not supposed to have bodhisattvas. See my round body? That's a bodhisattva. I said, yeah, very good, very good. Juwayo, juwayo. And it did actually happen, I must admit this. I was particularly fat one day in Nolomara. And this lady came up to me, a Chinese lady. She couldn't help herself, but... she rubbed my belly for good luck. Why not? I thought it was funny. May other people. I don't know if she got good luck, but anyway, she could give it a go. But so that's what you do with any heaviness. It's just your attitude towards it. So if that happens again, it's not a scary experience. Have fun with it, play with it, and it's not scary anymore. Dear Ajahn, would it be true to say that you can only experience jhanas and even nimittas following much practice of the Noble Eightfold Path? Yeah, it helps. The more you practice the Eightfold Path, obviously, the more chance you have of getting these jhanas. But sometimes, and this is weird, but people fluke jhanas. There was a good example is once I was teaching a retreat in Penang, it was about 6 or 7 years ago, and they said they had a friend of a friend who was in a big mess. She'd had some sort of problem and she'd been to a psychologist. No psychologist throughout the whole of Malaysia could help her. Can I give her an interview or a bit of counselling? So she came into the room. I didn't know what the problem was. And she said what had happened to her. And it was wonderful because when she said what had happened, I said, "Madam, you just had a jhana experience. I don't know how you got in there, but you fluked it. And you had one." I said, "These are the other things you experienced." And she said, "Yes, yes, at last somebody understands what I went through. I thought I was going crazy." So you weren't going crazy. For somehow or other, you pressed the letting go button and you really went into this deep state of meditation. And because I said other things which she hadn't told me, she realized I understood what she'd gone through. There's a jhana, that's all. I said, the chance of you getting one of those again are very, very remote, but this is what it was, this is what it meant. And she went away so happy. Realized she wasn't crazy, she understood what had happened because I knew what I was talking about. And sometimes that does occur, people fluke these things. And I've known a lot of people now, they listen to these teachings about jhanas and say, "My God, that's what I had." You know, somehow or other I just, either desperation because some tragedy in your life, or you just managed to be so peaceful just by chance and you just got into these experiences. And it's quite amazing how many people just fluke these things. They do it once, they don't know what they're up to, and it just happens. But you know, it's real jhanas. So they haven't even done Eightfold Path before, not even Buddhists, but it just happens. But obviously they can't repeat it, and it gets a bit disturbing because they don't know what's going on. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, this is my first ever retreat, and I'm pleased to say that it's been a mind-blowingly positive experience for me. Of course! I was born and raised a Buddhist, but it's only now that I've realized the true meaning of Buddhism. Yes, it's Mahayana. If the Buddha realized so much truth and wisdom 2600 years ago, then what the hell have humans been doing for so long? It's because instead of listening to the teachings of the Buddha, they just go bowing in front of statues. And that's one of the problems, that, you know, in traditional Buddhist countries, you just can't get close to the real teachings. It's all ritual instead. And so, as I said to Professor David Blair, he's the professor of physics, he went to Thailand when he was very young. He was very interested in Buddhism, but he said, I couldn't ask any questions. It was all chanting and rituals and bowing and offering food to monks. And that was it. You know, the real deep teachings, no one could actually give him. So I coined the phrase that, you know, in many Asian countries, you can't see the Buddha for the incense smoke. You know, it's just, you know, it gives a nice little metaphor there. There's so much incense, you can't actually see the real Buddha through all the rituals. So that's what humans have been doing. They made too much of a religion around Buddhism, and so no one can actually understand what the Buddha was teaching. So much for the progress that mankind have made so far. So much fuss and detail paid to developing and analysing the world around us, that for so long we humans have completely forgotten and ignored the world within us. And you know, and also an interesting thing, if you know Greek philosophy, Aristotle described the six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind. And he called mind the common sense, because whatever you smell, you see, you hear, you taste, you touch, now the mind also knows. And somehow or other in the Western world, now we've only got five senses. And apparently the sixth sense was a movie a few years ago. And that's what it's degenerated to. Originally, the Greeks had six senses. And over 2,500 years since Aristotle, 2,300, 400 years, the Western world has lost its mind and abandoned its common sense. And that explains a lot of why we're in so much trouble. So somehow or other we lost, you know, the understanding of a mind, you know, the world within us. During this retreat, I've also realized that I may have been lost and wandering around samsara for the last 2,500 years or so, give or take a few centuries. Venerable sir, I consider myself extremely lucky to be born as a human being during your lifetime. Oh my goodness. To be able to reap the direct benefits of your tireless efforts to rejuvenate Buddhism and its true meaning. During your talk this morning, I was once again awed by your words of wisdom and inspiration, but even more so by your acts of unconditional love and forgiveness. When I noticed I was sitting alongside residents from Karnak Prison Farm, whose lives you have transformed. Those people in green, they are criminals. We allow into this retreat center. These are people serving time for horrendous things. And they're in our midst. Ah! Well, you know, you're right in the middle of it. When you don't realize they're from the prison up the road, they're just nice guys. Isn't it amazing just how we can judge people? They're in prison doing time for something. We think, my goodness, they're dangerous. And if you don't tell them who they are, no, they're really nice people. So which one is true? Are they criminals or are they people? And of course, they are people. There is no such thing as a criminal. All there is people who have done crimes. There is no such thing as a rapist. It's just a person who's raped. There's a person there as well, you remember. There's no such thing as terrorists. There's people who do terrorist acts. There's no such thing as a monk. There's people who do monkey business. Okay. But I mean, you know the serious part of that. So don't judge anybody. So it's wonderful. They're here and they have a wonderful time. They really help out, you know, do work here. It's actually free labour. It's brilliant. And, you know, but no, they do what they really love doing. And they listen to Dharma. It's great, wonderful, just how we're changing people's lives. So I have a chat with them. Actually, you won't see them now because they don't come on Saturday or Sunday. So they really love, wonderful. And we had this one guy here some years ago. And he was a rapist, violently. And he actually cooked for the whole retreat. Amazing food. I couldn't believe just how well he cooked when he was here. Brilliant fellow. Really nice guy. So he wasn't a rapist. He was a person who raped. You know, I don't know why he did that, but you know, sometimes you talk to these people, they're wonderful people. Crazy, isn't it? So you give them a chance, you look at them as a person, and the bad part of them just vanishes away. And that's actually true. If you look at what they've done wrong, they'll repeat the wrongdoing. If you look at the other part of themselves, then they can see the good part of themselves. That part grows. And they never re-offend. That's like when I went to Singapore Institute of Mental Health for some ceremony there, and I gave a keynote address. And I told that, you know, my experience in prisons, I never seen any criminals in prison, just see people who commit crimes. And because I only see people who commit crimes, everybody, and this was one of my greatest accolades, a prison officer called me some years ago, and they said, can you please come back to the prison? It was Hakea prison. Can you please come back there to teach? And I said, I'm too busy these days. They said, no, we want you to come and teach. And I said, I'll send another monk. I said, no, I want you. I said, why me? And that's when the prison officer said he'd been teaching, no, he'd been a prison officer all his life. It was his career. He was about to retire. And he said, I've noticed, I remember what he said, this really sort of, you know, hit me and just gave me so much happiness. He said, I've noticed something unique with you, Ajahn Brahm. Every prisoner who came to your class never comes back to jail again when they're released. They never come back. That's why we want you back again. That's a beautiful sort of bit of praise. And I thought, why is that? And it's because I never saw any criminals. I saw people who did crimes. I saw the other part of them. And because I saw that, they saw it too. And that's why they never needed to reoffend. And I told that story, Institute of Mental Health, after which the fellow who was the head of the schizophrenia unit took me to his unit, you know, treating one campus which treats everybody with mental disabilities in Singapore. And I asked him, how do you treat schizophrenia? And he said, just like you said, Ajahn Brahm, I don't treat schizophrenia anymore. I treat the other part of the patients. And I was so impressed, I put my hands up and I worshipped him. I said, wow, you've got it, you've understood. And I know just how powerful that is. But I did ask him anyway, I said, what's the results like? He said, just so much better than conventional treatments. People in my unit, they're not schizophrenics. They're people who have episodes of schizophrenia. And I treat the people part of them. And that just grows and grows and grows until the schizophrenia gets squashed out. Now you know that makes a lot of sense, but few people have the guts to do it. That's how we treat criminals. They're not such things as criminals, they're people who've done crimes. Treat the other part of them. That grows so strong, the criminal part just gets squashed. You can either water the flowers or water the weeds. Water the flowers and they squash the weeds out. So anyway, before coming on this retreat, I made a donation of $4,000 to Dharamsala Nonsense Monastery to mark my 40th birthday in December 2012. Marvellous. In recognition of your inspirational work, I hereby pledge another $6,000, which I will transfer on my 60th birthday. No. No, they didn't say that. They say, on my return to this worthy cause that you have so passionately supported and defended. Excellent. That's marvellous. So all those donations, that's where you get the ability. I can teach, I can train other monks and nuns, but you know, you need a place for them to stay. And it does cost. So thank you for that. Whoever is that, they'll be very well appreciated by Dharamsala. And by everybody, so that we can have not just Ajahn Brahm sitting up here and teaching, but we can have Ajahn Gotami and Ajahn Pasada teaching retreats. That's Pasada and that's Gotami. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Have a whole retreat led by a bhikkhuni. And even better than mine, retreats. Someone from my cottage let her alarm clock ring at 4 a.m. Snooze every 5 minutes over half an hour. Apparently she's not aware of the existence of other mates. Could it be that she has done too much meditation? She's aware of her own existence only. May you not be long. Is that me or the other person in the room? Okay, it does happen. They were probably in jhana, because maybe in jhana you can't hear sound. So that's what you should have done. You should have got in jhana quickly, then you wouldn't have heard the alarm clock either. So please, you know, out of compassion, don't put the snooze alarm on. Just the first alarm is all you need. And as soon as you hear the alarm, what do? You jump up, sadhu, 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 another day of jhana growing, woohoo, yeah. That would disturb people like hell. No. Just, if you do need the alarm clock, just as soon as it goes off, turn it off and just get up out of bed. But the best, actually, don't have alarm clocks. You know, just, why do you want alarm clocks for? You know, just when you wake up, wake up. If it's early, you get up early. If it's late, get up late. And I guarantee you, 100%, you will wake up for 6:45. That's at breakfast, that's for sure. But anyway, please be forgiving to other people because they didn't mean it, they didn't do it on purpose, they haven't got it in for you, they didn't put their alarm clock right next to your door. I'm going to get her this morning. 4 o'clock. Now she's complained to me, tomorrow morning I'm going to do it at 3 o'clock. They're complaining. No, they don't do it on purpose. So. Dear Ajahn, following on from the story of King Rama being a deva, presumably he had done so much good karma in his human life to be reincarnated as a deva. What then? Isn't life immortal as a deva? How do devas escape the cycle of samsara by becoming immortal? They don't escape. They're just in a deva realm for a while. And then when that karma is all used up, then they have to come back to another life again. Just like when you go on holiday. When you run out of cash, you've got to come home and go to work again. And sometimes when you go on holiday, that happens sooner than you expected. So you've got to come back and make some more money. So this is what we do. Deva realm is like going on holiday. You have a nice time because you made lots of good karma. When you run out of good karma, you have to come back and make some more. It's entering jhana, the release of dimethyltryptamine from the pineal gland in your brain. I think you've stumped me there. I will say I don't know, because I haven't got a clue what dimethyltryptamine is. If it was, then we can just inject people with this stuff, and you won't need to work so hard to get jhana. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a jhana pill? So instead of actually working so hard and having to sit for hours and hours and hours and have sore butts and sore legs and get frustrated because you can't even, just get a pill. You get a pill, the jhana pill, and you sit down and you get nimittas first of all, beautiful. We could do this actually with visual reality. You know, you've got these goggles with visual reality, so you get a nice nimitta coming up in visual reality. Virtual reality, that's right, virtual reality goggles. So you get a beautiful nimitta, and we can actually make the nimittas real ones. I can actually design them for you. So they get really good, and they just look like real ones, and they will trick you in going into jhana. No, even if you did get to jhana that way, you wouldn't have learned how to let go, which is the most important thing. It could be, but I don't know. Your nothingness, Ajahn Brahm, your roundness, remember. Or your round nothingness, or nothing roundness. When the Buddha to be sat under the Bodhi tree, he made a determination that he will not get up from the seat until he's fully enlightened. Was that not a wanting? Please explain kindly. Yes. Because remember, the Buddha wasn't a Buddha yet. You know, he was still stupid. You know, till after his enlightenment, then he became a Buddha, and then his aspirations were okay. So that was actually not a really good aspiration. And I remember when I was a student at Cambridge, this was my first Waisak. We had a monk come up, I think it was Dr. Sadatissa. He came up to Cambridge to do like a talk for Waisak. And he told the story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, and as Buddha to be. And making the determination, even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this seat until I get perfect full enlightenment. And I was really inspired by that. This is a true story. So inspired, after the sermon was finished, I went back to my room in college. And I was meditating, maximum 20 minutes. And I sat down and I said, well, if the Buddha can do it, so can I. I mean, when the Buddha was an Indian, I'm English. I mean, we're much better than those Indians. We can do this. And, you know, I've got a good degree, so I can do this. So, well, I was going to get one anyway, not yet. So I sat down and I made it. I'm serious. I mean, I really meant it. I say, even though my blood turns to dust, and my blood dries up, my bones turn to dust, I, Peter Betts, are not going to move from this seat until I get full enlightenment. You know, you're a student, you had lots to do. You've got to get this out of the way so you can do all the other stuff in life which you have to do. So it would be great getting enlightenment out of the way, the first way, second, then you'd be free to do all sorts of other stuff. Like have sex, get married, and you know, watch the football and all this other stuff. That's how you think when you're young. So I sat down there. And I lasted about, it was actually quite good, about 40 minutes, between 35 and 40 minutes. By that time, I was in absolute agony. You know, I mean, really big pain. And I couldn't stand it any longer. So I got up and, you know, I wasn't enlightened. And I looked and my blood was still wet and my bones hadn't turned to dust. It was really a down. I really got disappointed after that. And I actually tried that. It's actually stupidity. It was too much willpower, thinking, okay, I can do this. Maybe a Buddha to be with all his preparation can do that, because it's just that last little bit. You know, I've done so much letting go over so many lifetimes. Maybe a Buddha can do that, but not us. So don't try that. Please don't do that in this retreat, otherwise we'll have to call the ambulance. I guarantee neither will you become enlightened, neither will your bones turn to dust. You'll just go crazy, that's all. Could you kindly explain the state and condition for persons who are meditating and persons who seldom or never meditated during their last breath of life? What really brings them to the next circle of life? It's like wanting. And if you're meditating, you've let go of wanting. So there's a good chance, the more you've meditated, that when it comes time to die, you can totally let go and become still. And if you're really still, I mean perfectly still when you die, when the bus comes to take you to your next life, they look around and they won't see anybody there. You're too still, you disappear. And they'll go off without you. No more rebirth. That's the end. That's a little metaphor. There's no bus, but it's a nice metaphor. But if you move, they'll see you and then they'll put you in the bus and take you to your next life. In daily life, if we encounter any problems and we need your advice, how do we ask for it? Send to the email, WA Buddhist Association, on your personal email number. Thanks, may yours be... No! Oh, come on. How many of me, I say, and how many of you? This is not the only retreat I teach. I teach hundreds of retreats every year, and it's put on YouTube as well. There are thousands of people. I would never be able to answer everyone's emails. So, if you encounter any problems, best of luck, mate. Basically. Well, there's so many YouTube talks. Look at the YouTube talks. Look at the books. That's why all the answers are in there. So anyway, if you have any problems, maybe we can actually do a recorded message for the problems. You know, like you can actually have this list of problems, you know, the standard problems, and that you can get the answers for it. And the answer is, very good. So they're very easy to do, Dan. It's just any problem, the same answer, very good. And if they say, no, we want more detailed advice, then the answer would be, just make peace, be calm, be gentle. So every question. So that'd be very good. So that's my answer to all questions. Dear Ajahn, I would like to thank you for visiting me in hospital last year, where I really thought I would not make it. Your chanting saved my life, and I'm here to say, why didn't you let me go? No, you didn't say that. I'm here to tell the story. Thank you very much. Much better to you. You see, it's magic. We can save people's lives and keep them alive. They're supposed to die, but they don't. But I must admit, I did get into trouble once. I was asked by a family to go and chant for their father who was dying. So I went in the hospital, I did some chanting, and he got better. And they really scolded me. They said, look, we didn't want you to do the getting better chanting. You know, we were just ready. We prepared for him to go. You know, we'd take months actually getting used to the idea he was going to die. Now he's going to die, and you come along and you get him alive again. Don't ever do that again, Ajahn Brahm. So please, if you ask me to do some chanting, please, you know, ask me what chanting is, whether, you know, is getting him alive again or getting him to die chanting. So I don't stuff up next time. But they were very upset at me. They said, oh, why'd you do that before I jumped off? You know, it's really hard letting somebody go. We got ourselves used to the idea he's dying, and now he's alive again. Gee, some monks, you can't trust these monks these days. So anyway, well done. Coming out of meditation today, I have discovered a reason why the nuns don't get much support, and the answer lays with the translation of the Metta Sutta. Well done, this is my favourite question. One of the lines says, omitting none. Is that you?
No, I didn't write it.
No, that's probably you. How's it go?
And then let nuns deceive another?
Yeah. Let nuns deceive another. No. Let none deceive you. Okay. Sorry about that. You're in big trouble. The great or the mighty omitting none. And I think this is being interpreted by our mind as omitting none. So we are sending all our happiness to all beings but the nuns community. We have to do something. Well, I believe I've got two options. First option would be to delete this line, but the second option is more interesting. Instead of deleting it, we can modify it, omitting monks. That's what it says here. One could say, omitting monks. We try that tomorrow. So all the money and donation goes to the nuns, and the monks will suffer. We don't suffer. I might actually lose some weight after a while. But more intended would be to put a secret subliminal message so we get some funds. The message could be omitting those who haven't donated $1,000 to the nuns. I think this idea would work. Give it a crack. Okay. I'll try. May all die sooner rather than later. It's interesting. That's one of those, somebody told me that, they said in some sort of joke, they said that we'll all die sooner or later. And someone said, I'll take the later. In your piece entitled The Jhanas 2003, you describe the complete inaccessibility from the world of the five senses and one's body only as a fact of the fourth jhana. Why then do you verbally state this as a fact of the previous also? I don't know what I wrote then, but it's usually all the jhanas. Five senses, one's body is actually a fact of all the jhanas. In my experience, you may experience a sound in jhana 1 to 3, but one pointness is so strong, virtually zero attention is placed on it. Please clarify, this has baffled me for years. Well, I don't know what I said in 2003. But I know what I say now. They say a thorn to the first jhana is the sound. That is the first jhana. In other words, that can actually sort of penetrate and take you out. But they say if you've only got a weak first jhana and a sound comes, a really loud sound, and it's only a weak first jhana, then you're out of the jhana when you hear the sound. And as Ajahn Brahmani was saying the other day, it's just the same as the thorn for the second jhana is vitakka vichara. We all know that vitakka vichara is gone in the second jhana. But it's a thorn. In other words, if there is a slight movement of the mind, it takes you out of the second jhana into the first jhana. So logically, it can't have any sound in any of the jhanas. Well, the whole senses are gone. So I don't know what I said in 2003, but that was passé. And I don't know actually why I said that, because that's not true. Dear Ajahn, all of us should appreciate the workload and contribution made by Bianca, who's in the back there. She works 16 or more hours to make us comfortable. For the benefit of others to know, she conducts meditation classes on weekends at Dhammaloka. She makes meditation cushions and sells them to raise funds for the nuns. It's for the nuns, isn't it? Yeah, for the nuns. So if you want to raise funds for nuns, buy an extra cushion. And her meals are simple and tasty. I'm not condemning the others who bring dana. They bring so many items with lots of metta. We should be mindful in eating. Please let all of us say sadhu 3 times to Bianca. Okay? Sadhu. Sadhu. sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So she does this. This is her dharma. She never asked for any money. Never sort of asked to be paid for this. This is a holiday. She's a relief teacher. So imagine, on your holidays, you spend 16 hours a day serving others. That's why she's so happy. Dear Ajahn, my son, 24 years, SMSs me asking to teach him what I learn here. Where should he start? Oh, it's great that, you know, he's asking to learn. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Just send him a few of these CDs. Once the CDs are finished, which they will be, they're usually done the next the day that the retreat ends, and you can send him a CD of the talks. So that's a good place to start. Dear Ajahn, when one reaches higher states, jhanas in meditation, please clarify that it is the meditator who cannot feel his body, breath, pulse, etc., due to his mind being so detached from the body. Surely his physical feelings will still be detectable in that person's body by a passerby. How can you explain a meditator being in a state of jhana for hours or days and then returning back to his human body if the human body has stopped these essential functions of breathing, circulation, etc.? The physical body would then have ceased and started decaying within hours, well before the mind returns from its state of jhana. Please explain with metta. No, even to a passerby, you're not breathing, and there is no pulse. I told a story over in Singapore somewhere of Greg. He very rarely comes to Buddhist society now, so I don't mind telling his name. But he was a guy who would only usually meditate half an hour, 40 minutes max. And one Sunday afternoon, there was nothing on the TV. So he told his wife, I'm going into my bedroom to meditate. And after an hour and a half, he hadn't come out. So his wife went to check on him and saw him still sitting meditation in his bedroom, perfectly still, too still. His chest wasn't moving. So she called 000, which in Australia is the emergency number. Within 5 minutes, an ambulance came. The medics rushed in. They saw he wasn't breathing. They felt his pulse. These were trained medics. They could find no pulse. They put him in the back of the ambulance. And the wife went with them. Sirens wailing all the way to Sir Charles Gardner Hospital. Straight into the emergency room. This was an emergency. No pulse, no heart, nothing happening. He was dead. And they put an ECG onto his heart. It was a flat line. Ding, 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 emergency. It doesn't go ding, 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 unfortunately, but I just add that because it makes the story sound much better. Ding, 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 emergency. heart failure. And then he put the EEG onto his head to see if there's any brain activity. Another perfect flat line. He was brain dead. And he, cardiac arrest. Now, his wife, she was just so scared. She thought her husband had died. So, what did the doctor do? The doctor was an Indian guy. And thank goodness for that. Because the Indian guy had heard his parents say that sometimes, in deep meditation, you can suspend all your life faculties. And he heard from his wife he'd been meditating, so maybe... this was just a state of deep meditation. So the doctor put defibrillators on his chest, which passed electric shock, boom, boom. He jumped off from the gurney many times, still flat line. Many times, still flat line. He didn't actually say how long, half an hour they tried to resuscitate him, nothing worked. Until he decided to come out of his meditation. He opened his eyes, he leant up, he was flat on his back. He said, what am I doing here? I'm in my bedroom. What's happened? And as soon as he opened his eyes, beep, 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 ECG and EEG were perfect. And the doctor, it was a Sunday afternoon, the doctor gave him a thorough examination, could find absolutely nothing wrong with him at all, so let him walk home with his wife. And I remember him telling me that story. And Number one, I said, what did you do special that time to get into such a deep jhana? And he said, and they all say the same thing, but I remember he was saying, I really let go for the first time. I really let go. Exactly. That is how you get into jhanas. You really let go. No messing around. And how did you feel at the time? Did you feel the defibrillators? I couldn't feel anything. I was just blissed out. This is the most wonderful experience I've ever had in my whole life. It's just so peaceful, so blissed. Exactly, that's jhana. And there was very hard evidence with defibrillators on your chest. You couldn't feel a thing. And the sound of the siren of the ambulance, da 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 da. Haven't got any idea what's going on. Deep inside, having the time of your life. That's a true story. So, this is what happens. Even passers-by, they think you're dead. But the other thing of that story, which sometimes I forget to say, I mentioned it earlier, and about what happens, the difference between people in jhana and people who are dead. This is actually from the Chulavedala Sutta. They ask, what's the difference? And they say, the body is warm for a person in jhana. And apparently this doctor, that was one of the other reasons why he put the defibrillators on him. Because it looked like he was dead. But the one sign, which was different than a normal dead body, under cardiac arrest, brain dead, was his body was continually warm. And that's one of the reasons they gave him defibrillators. And that's exactly what it says in the suttas. That's actually amazing. So there we go, a true story. Don't worry, if you get into a jhana, don't worry about these things. You know, we won't send you to the hospital, we'll just look at your plane ticket, we'll put you on the aircraft, and you just come out, you know, the middle of the ocean somewhere, just up there, and say, how did I get up here? I said, okay, we checked you in for you. I know lots of people, Singapore Airlines will be okay, because I know lots of people who work for Singapore Airlines in Perth Airport. We just put you on the plane and check you in for you. Re-samatha vipassana relationship. I would like to share a quote from Bhante Dhammawuddho that clarified this in my mind. I know who Dhammawuddho is. That's Sister Gotami's brother, who is a monk over in Malaysia. Samatha draws us towards nibbana, vipassana repels us away from samsara. Fair enough. Also, in regard to mind-body connection, I would like to share an excerpt from Ayakema's autobiography, I Give You My Life. During the operation, a strange thing occurred. It must be her operation. Although I was fully anaesthetized the whole time, I suddenly heard an unknown doctor saying, oh, for God's sake, something has to be done immediately. I saw him clearly before me, although my eyes were tightly closed. I heard someone say, 80 over 50, and that was life-threatening. I was also clearly aware that my body was lying there completely numb, and that in the meantime my mind had separated from my body and was watching the whole proceeding from a bird's eye view. My mind was absolutely calm. I only felt bad for the doctors, and I wanted to help them attain calmness as well. So that's a classic out-of-the-body experience. That is what happens. Floating out of your body and seeing everything which is going on. So that's actually from a nun who's obviously someone you can trust. But my favourite Ayakema story, you know what's coming next, don't you? Because I told this a lot just before I went to Las Vegas. Because once Ayakema, she was teaching a retreat, this is quite a famous Buddhist nun, Bhikkhuni. She was teaching, as she's dead now, she was teaching a retreat in England. And on the way back from the retreat centre to Heathrow Airport, her driver, Anya Takta, who I know very well also, confirmed this story so many times, it was absolutely accurate. They stopped for lunch. And if you've ever been to England, a lot of the places you stop for lunch are next to pubs. And the only way to get actually into the restaurant was actually go through the front of the pub. So they went through the front of the pub. But, you know, the pubs, they're not like bars. They're just, you know, they're very respectable in England. Sometimes they're really old buildings, beautiful buildings. And so he went through the front of the pub, into the restaurant, to have their lunch. And she was still eating. And Anya, she had a few English coins left, which, you know, waste of time trying to change into other currencies. So there was one of these little, they call them pokey machines in Australia. in English they call them one-armed bandit. You know, you push the pull the handle, and all these numbers go around, oranges and jackpots and stuff. You know those machines I'm talking about. They have them in all of the casinos. And what do they call them in the United States? Jackpot machines. Yeah, you know, you just pull the handle and they go around. But anyway, so she was just getting rid of the coins, you know, putting £2 coin in, put in the handle, nothing happened. She just put a £2 coin in when Aya came and walked past having finished her lunch. And Anya said to Aya Kama, "You're a Buddhist nun. You've got all the good karma. You pull the handle." And in a moment of mindlessness, Aya, just out of compassion, pulled the handle. She should not have done that. Because what happened next, the numbers went round. Absolutely true story. She did have good karma. Jackpot. And all this money, they're trying to get rid of the coins. And now they had all these coins coming out, hundreds. And because this was in the front of the bar, in the pub, everybody, all the patrons drinking, fell totally silent. They looked at this nun. And the next thing they said happened was the bartender rang the bell, ding, 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 and explained to this nun that it was a tradition. You know about traditions in UK. Traditions, no matter how stupid they are, have to be kept. And the tradition was whoever won the jackpot had to buy a free round of drinks to everybody in the pub. So Aya Kama, this Buddhist nun, this bhikkhuni, had no choice but to buy gin and tonics, whiskies, pints of beer, and anything they wanted, thereby breaking all her precepts, not all of them, but a lot of them, simply because she pulled the handle. So you never do that as a monk, so don't, you know, ask me to do that, because if I did it, we'd always win. How many nimittas and jhanas are there? There's four jhanas. Nimittas is uncountable. Does each nimitta an indicator for non-coming jhana? No, just nimitta is just a nimitta. It's prior to the first jhana. Dear Ajahn, you explain by doing any method of meditation, vipassana, samatha, anapanasati, metta, you reach the same destination. We cover the anapanasati, which is breathing in and breathing out. Vipassana is just doing nothing. Am I correct? So what is samatha? I'm new to this. Please explain. Now, vipassana is using insight, and I did give a talk about how you use insight to get your mind to be peaceful. So, you know, there's a lot of, instead of using willpower, use wisdom power. You know, things like any problem in meditation, the anger-eating demon, give it kindness rather than ill will, and then you find the problem disappears. You're getting insight. You know, wanting makes you more tense. The insight says when you don't want, then it gets very peaceful. That's insight meditation. You use insight to get peaceful. And samatha is just becoming peaceful. So this is, they're all exactly the same, just different words. Dear Ajahn Brahm, before we leave this centre, if we could purchase CDs on your inspirational talks about meditation, I'd be greatly appreciated. Yes, that will be done. It is beautiful to listen to your words, day and night, which always reminds us about the correct thing to do. So please let us purchase some CDs. Many thanks. Whoever wrote that has got great insight. You must be so close to enlightenment already, because you really appreciate the finer things of life. Okay. Venerable Ajahn, how many jhanas are there? Somebody's been copying from other people. This is another one. There are four jhanas. Is jhana the blissful state of mind? Yes. Once you achieved it, how long does it last for? A long time. Once you get it, means you can achieve it whenever you do a meditation? No. Because this is the big problem for people. They get one jhana and then they want. And that's not the cause for jhana. So remember, if you achieve one of these deep states of meditation, understand why. Where did it come from? What was the cause for these deep meditations? And recreate the causes. Forget about the results. Your job is to recreate the causes. The not wanting, the contentment, the peace, the kindness, the letting go, not trying to attain things. Those are the causes. Put those causes in place and the results will come. What is the secret Buddha in the garden? Where is it? Goodness should be open to share with everyone. By the way, we're going to have a party tomorrow. The party will be in the secret garden. If you don't know where it is, I'm sorry, you're not invited. You've got to have a look for it. Someone will be able to tell you where it is. The other night you touched on how the positive energy of one person can flow into another, particularly after metta meditation. Does it work the same with negative energy? For example, I spent 4 days over the Christmas period with my folks. Both are extremely negative people, particularly when they're together. After the 4 days, I too felt very negative, sad. I couldn't wait to get out of there. I'm also concerned that you inherit such qualities, trait. Do you get such stuck with these? I.e., is it underlying negative negation, whatever? Thanks. So it must be that it's in your genes to be negative. Your parents are so negative, so you're in big trouble. No, it's nothing to do with your genes. But it is true. If you hang around positive people, you do get positive energy. If you hang around negative people, it's very easy to get negative energy. That's why it's great to hang around, you know, in a retreat with really good people, or hang out with monks, hang out with nuns, if you possibly can. We usually like being by ourselves, you know, out of solitude, because, yeah, you get positive energy hanging out with us, but what do you think we get? Hanging out with you. That's why I have to be very compassionate. Yeah, it does work. So, I remember that, just going to visit my folks at Christmas time. My family, big family. You know what it's like at Christmas? They all come at Christmas. Ah, how are you? I haven't seen you for 6 months, for a year. How are you? And everyone was very nice for about 10 minutes. And then they start getting, you know, all the arguments and just, but you never sent me a Christmas card, did you? Yeah, but because you didn't do this and that. And, oh, geez, just the arguments which go on in the family. So anyway, sort of, you know, you have to go to the family, but you be a positive. And then you can actually give a lot of positive energy to your parents. And when you run out of positive energy, get your CD out and listen to a talk, Ajahn Brahma, one of the nuns or somebody or other, get some positive energy up, and then you can go and give some of that to your parents. But it's not genetic. My parents were actually very, very good. But my father's father. And I love telling this story because I tell a lot about my father. He's a very, very kind man and very wise. But his father was from Liverpool. And my dad would never talk about my grandfather who died during the Second World War. And one day, I must have been about 14 or 15, I really pressed my dad. I said, why don't you talk about my grandfather? You know, I'd like to know who he was and what he did. And so my father, please excuse me, but my father said, your grandfather, my father, was a bastard. And that's what he said. I thought, my goodness, what are we saying that to your father for? And then he sort of let on what happened. He was a plumber in Liverpool during the Depression years, so money was very tight. And whatever money he got from work, he'd just go to the pub and come home drunk every night. Coming home drunk, he'd just get off his leather belt and just hit anybody who came in his path for no reason whatsoever. And then he'd lay into his wife. My father's mother. It was gross domestic abuse, which was not uncommon in those days. But my father said, whenever I was at the end of a whipping with that belt, I'd never done anything wrong, just my father was drunk. He said, I made a resolution, if ever I make it through this, if ever I have children, I will never ever do that to my kids. And he never did. He could not discipline us at all. Because, you know, to discipline us was remembering what happened to him. And I say that because sometimes people think if you're a victim of sexual abuse or physical abuse, that everybody who's a victim will revisit that abuse on their children. It doesn't always work that way. Because anecdotally, my father, he was a victim of domestic abuse, parental abuse. But instead of just revisiting it on myself and my brother, he just couldn't do that. He changed. He turned it around. He learned from the pain to be a very, very kind, loving man. It can be done. So maybe some of you may have been abused physically, sexually. It doesn't mean that you have to visit that abuse on your children. Instead, you can learn from it. The old story of digging in the shit. Dig the shit under the mango tree and your mangoes are sweeter and juicier than other mango trees. That was my father. He dug it in. Really good on him. At the age of 49, I still haven't got my driver's license. My partner and I will soon be moving to a remote area and it will be helpful if I can drive. However, I have such a fear about learning to drive. Can you please talk a little bit about practicing with our fears? Okay, sometimes, you know, what are you afraid of? So it's not the fear of driving. It must be just, first of all, find out what you're really afraid of. Is it fear of crashing? And if you're afraid of crashing, you can always drive with a crash helmet. And you know the stuff they've got for the American football, the pads here and pads there. So, you know, that will take away your fear of crashing. What else can you be afraid of? Afraid of actually hurting somebody else. You can actually put some nice soft bags and like tie a mattress on the front of the car if you're afraid of like hurting kangaroos in the bush so you won't sort of hurt anything or you won't dent the car. So, you know, find out what you're really afraid of and just do something about it. So you can, you know, be in your car with the helmets and just padding all over and a big mattress in the front of the car. What else would you be afraid of? You know, I don't know what you're afraid of. Running out of gas, have a few extra sort of petrol cans in the back. Find out what you're afraid of. Next, it's not just driving. It must be something else. And then once you've pinpointed what the real fear is, you can do something about it. Today, I had a big negative reaction to someone in my mind. I was surprised at first and disappointed because I thought I was in a happy, kind state. Then this got me thinking, oh no, about the authenticity of my happy, peaceful state. Have I just been generating this at the surface level of my mind? Just in the same way I can do this by indulging in a happy, feel-good movie, only to have the feeling fade away shortly afterwards. I'm not sure what I really think, but I know this will pop into my mind after retreat. May you live a short, lazy, wicked or empty life? A wide. Wide or empty. It's not wicked, it's wide. Thank goodness for that. Perhaps your term, your holiness, is used for saintly people because there's really nothing there. Yes, your holiness. Very good. Anyway, something comes up in your mind. Remember, just, it's par for the course. So you're having a happy, peaceful state, but it didn't last all the time. And so the reason why you had this negative reaction to someone in your mind, because without the negative reaction, you wouldn't appreciate the happiness. You know, you need something opposite to actually really appreciate the happiness. If you were happy all the time, you'd just take it for granted and you wouldn't value it. So this negative reaction was wonderful. When you have a negative reaction, then you appreciate the happiness which comes afterwards. Well done. That's why they say that this was a Christian idea of heaven. If you go to heaven, you have to, one day a year, you have to go to hell. Because otherwise you wouldn't appreciate heaven anymore. You just take it for granted. So you go down to hell for one day so you can really appreciate sort of what heaven is really all about. So this was wonderful. You had a negative reaction so you could appreciate the value of happiness. It was a great teaching for you. So welcome it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I would like to officially become a Buddhist. Do I need to take the three refuges? No, you just need to shave your hair and get some brown robes on. No, you don't. I'm only joking. Officially become a Buddhist, do I need to take the three refuges? Do I need to remember them in Pali, or can I just wing it using the chanting book? Or can I say them in English? Do you or any of the other monks or nuns have time during this retreat to give us the three refuges? Thank you with metta. You can take the three refuges. That is a traditional way of becoming a Buddhist. But for me, I never took the three refuges or the five precepts. I just, you know, read my books on Buddhism, listened to a few talks, realized I was a Buddhist. I didn't need to be baptized or circumcised or anything else size, thank goodness. I just realized I was a Buddhist and that was it. And so even the precepts. You know, I never took the precepts and I learned them. I was meditating. It didn't make any sense to kill anybody or kill any, even animal. I actually became a vegetarian, you know, before I realized what I was doing. And then I sort of, you know, no stealing. When I was young in London as a kid, I always thought if the bus conductor who was supposed to take the fares, if they didn't ask, then you didn't need to give it to them. And then I realised I didn't feel comfortable with that. It was still stealing. And so I'd always actually go and pay even if they didn't ask. So you know, I was keeping that precept. You know, I gave up, and I always had one girlfriend. I never see the point of having two girlfriends. Adultery. Now, one girlfriend is enough suffering. They're really expensive as well. The student. I just couldn't afford to. that's the fact of the matter. So that's why I always say that if you're a young person, there's a couple of young people here. If you're young, if you're a girl, please never marry a wealthy man. Marry a poor one. Because if you marry a wealthy one, they can afford a mistress. You know what Chinese men are like? That's true. But if they are poor, then you're safe. You know they can't afford a mistress. So you've got them for the rest of your life. And if you're a guy, never marry a drop-dead, gorgeous, beautiful girl. Because then somebody else would like her and have adultery. But if you marry an ugly girl, really ugly one, then you're perfectly safe. No one will want her except you. And so you don't have to worry about adultery at all for the rest of your life. You'll have a happy time together. So that's the secret for happy marriage. Girls marry poor guys. Guys marry ugly girls. It's logical. I don't know why more people don't do that. I'm going to get into that one. I forget. Yeah, so for the three refugees, yeah, so no adultery, and I gave up lying, and I just gave up alcohol. I didn't really feel the need for it anymore. And I remember just going to the Thai temple in London, been going there a long time, and one of the monks came up to me and said, "You've been coming here such a long time, it's about time you took the three refuges and five precepts." I remember them asking me that. I said, "Well, what are the three refuges?" "You know, it's just a sign you're a Buddhist." "Well, I'm a Buddhist already. I've never taken them, but I'm a Buddhist." "You know, it means refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha." "Yeah, I do that all the time." "What about the five precepts?" And he said, I asked him, "What are the five precepts you want me to take?" And he said, "No, not killing, stealing, committing adultery, not lying, not taking alcohol or non-medicinal drugs. I've been doing that for months. So I don't need to take them. Thank you very much. Bye-bye." And that was it. Because I was keeping them already. So the real taking the precepts is in your heart. You don't need to chant them. If you want to do the ceremony, fine. The same with going for refuge. You don't need to do the ceremony because you know, I'm a Buddhist, that's who I am. And that's good enough. But if you want to do the precepts and the refuges, you can ask either myself, or ask one of them, take it with the nuns. It'd be wonderful. So you know, you can do that for them. Last question. My friend who was married with two children killed himself a few months ago. All of his family and friends, including his wife, cannot get their heads around it. As he did not display any depressive symptoms, let alone suicidal ones. The doctor said it's possible for the brain to snap. Is this true? Also, what would his rebirth be like? And of course, in my position, I've had to deal with the families of many people who have committed suicide, so I've got some experience in this area. And the common theme is the person who kills themselves, no one ever suspects it. The ones who really commit suicide. The ones who so shines, you know, don't usually kill themselves. They maybe sort of try, but they try half-heartedly, they want to be stopped. But the real ones, the danger ones, the ones who actually do commit suicide, no one ever suspects. They don't tell anybody, they hide it and they just do it. But I remember, there's this one guy. This is a funny story, it's absolutely true. He used to be our caretaker over in Nolomara some years ago. And, you know, he was by himself. He was an ex-bricklayer. He was a nice guy. He's from Gloucester in UK. Really great guy. And, you know, after a while, he decided he wanted to have some solitude. So he moved over to Beverley. And when he was in Beverley, living by himself, he got depressed one day. And he decided to commit suicide. And what he actually did, he had a big shed. He tied the rope in the shed to the beam, tied a noose, now got the chair ready, you know, just so that he could put the noose on his head and kick the chair away from him. And he went into his caravan where he was staying, to write the suicide note. And as he was writing the suicide note, he had the radio on. And as he was listening to the radio, writing the suicide note, who would come on the radio? Ajahn Brahm. And he said, oh no, Ajahn Brahm won't let me commit suicide. And he gave up, he untied the rope and everything, and he came and told me about it afterwards. We were laughing our heads off. He says, see, it's a waste of time you try and commit suicide. I'll catch you. I'll stop you. And he gave up. He's still alive today. Really nice fellow. But yeah, sometimes that people actually they do that. And when they actually do commit suicide, number one, no guilt. Because it's always a family, always feel guilty. They think, oh, if only I'd have said something, if only I hadn't been so hard on them, if I only hadn't told that really bad joke last night. So sometimes, if you commit suicide tonight because of my bad jokes, I am not going to feel guilty at all. It's not my fault. It's just you don't appreciate the finer parts of humour, that's all. So number one, we try and make sure that no one feels guilty. It's no one's fault. It happens and no one can spot it. That's the truth of the matter of suicide. So no one's fault. Number two, don't blame the person who killed themselves. You know, they made a mistake. It's not a good thing to do. It's a stupid thing to do. But we all do stupid things from time to time. People get themselves into, again, just a weird state of mind. And no one is there to help them. And they just don't want any help. They just hide it anyway and they just do that. So don't blame. No guilt, no anger. And it's just part of life. It happens sometimes. And so when it happens, you know, what we do afterwards is thank the person. They can die for many, many different reasons. It could be a cardiac arrest. It could be an accident in the car. It could be the suicide. Don't just put suicide in a different category to everything else. It's just part of life. Just like a cardiac arrest. It just happens. You might call it like a brain arrest. And number two, lastly, what happens to them after they die? There was a young Sri Lankan man who committed suicide a few years ago, and he was just about to do his tertiary entrance examinations to get into university. And he, you know, hung himself one morning, and they asked that question, what's going to happen to my kid? And I told them afterwards, I said, look, you know, the kid was about to do an examination to get into university. How many subjects, first of all? He said five subjects. How many papers for each subject? Maybe two papers for each subject, that's 10 exams. How many questions in each exam? Well, maybe roughly 8 per exam. So 80 questions he would have to answer to get into university. What would happen if one question he made a big mess of? Totally wrong answered. Would that mean he wouldn't be able to go to university? He said, no, what about the 79 other questions? He could answer 79 questions perfectly and just mess up one question. He said, that's your son. He just messed up the last question of his life and committed suicide. 79 other questions were perfect questions. He was a good boy. So he can still go to university. He can still go to heaven. So have a good rebirth. You never just judge a whole life by one mistake made at the end of the life, a suicide. No more than you can judge an examination just on one question. It may be the last question, it may be the most important question, but all the other questions are important too. So when I tell people about that, they get the message, yes, suicide is a stupid thing to do, but you should not judge a life just by that last act. What else did they do in their life? What other kind, good, wonderful, beautiful things did your son do? Or in this case, you know, that husband do. And if they've been generally a really, really good person, a kind person, generous, whatever it was, then you don't have to worry about them. Just one bad act at the end won't stop their going to have a good rebirth. That makes a lot of sense. It's amazing, we just see one act, one bad brick in a wall, and that's all we see, and we get so negative. See the whole picture, the whole life, the whole exam, not just one question. And then it makes a lot of sense. And there you have the answer. And it's almost 9:30. It's past 9:30 already. We've gone over time. And if you go over time, you get a bit tired. And when you get tired, you get grumpy. And when you get grumpy, you get suicidal. We don't want anyone to commit suicide this evening, so we better stop while the going is good. So I hope you enjoyed the question and answers tonight. So now we have the three sadhus. Are you ready? This is important. Give it everything you've got. Full mindfulness, full joy, full concentration. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.